I'm John Hockenberry. This is the Takeaway Podcast.
This is the end. Beautiful friend.
Strange theories this hour, remarkable discoveries, questionable claims, and unsatisfying endings. That's what's in store for us this hour as we peer widely into the cosmos and then land in the fragile point of light in a single eye and one fragile human life who gave it for the people of Syria, a people still dying in their civil war. We remember this hour the courage and complexity of the late war correspondent Marie Colvin with her last collaborator, Paul Conroy.
Gaddafi certainly has supporters. There's a lot of people who are angry at him and want him out. I would say there's a larger population that wants change, but is very nervous of the violence that could entail. Millions on the street saying, "I love you, Gaddafi." I don't see it.
The voice of Marie Colvin on the Takeaway from Tripoli, Libya, almost exactly 2 years ago on this program. More about Marie Colvin later this hour, but first, Alfred Nobel invented dynamite. Peter Higgs predicted something that has been dynamite in the world of particle physics. The Higgs boson, named for Peter Higgs, the supermassive particle predicted by cosmologists and string theorists to be the subatomic agent that confers the mysterious and essential property of mass to all matter. Higgs gets the Nobel Prize for Physics, we learned today, along with Belgian theorist François Englert, honoring the prediction, at least partially confirmed, by the CERN Large Hadron Super Collider in July of 2012. Joining us now, Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. Brian, welcome.
Thank you, John.
So what does this confer? It's a great theory, is what the Nobel is honoring here, a great experimental result. Exactly how does this parse out from your view?
Well, all of the above. It is a tremendous insight that Peter Higgs and François Englert and his now deceased collaborator Robert Brout gave the world in the 60s, this idea of how to give mass to fundamental particles. But it was just an idea when it was put forward. It was just math. And then through the powerful collisions at the Large Hadron Collider, recreating conditions unseen since the Big Bang, that idea was confirmed through experiment.
Now, you've done enormous amounts of work on string theory, superstring theory, and the cosmology of all this. Take us back to the 60s. How hard was it for Peter Higgs and his collaborators and François Englert to think ahead, to sort of really imagine their way to this moment the Nobel Prize is honoring?
Well, they did what most theorists spend their lives doing, which is put forward ideas to solve crucial problems. And the crucial problem of that time was how to confer heft, mass, resistance to being moved, accelerated to fundamental particles. And they did it through pure equations. It was a brilliant insight, a powerful idea. But usually when we theorists put forward mathematical ideas, they're ultimately wrong, not because we make a mistake, but because nature doesn't make use of all the ideas that come out of a human brain. Here's a wonderful case where what they thought of actually describes how the universe works.
How does a particle that seems to have mass all by itself confer mass? That confuses me and a lot of other folks.
Well, the idea is that without this Higgs notion, which I should probably say envisions, that space itself is filled with an invisible substance, a kind of cosmic molasses is not a bad way of thinking about it. Then when other particles like the electron try to move through the cosmic molasses, this Higgs field, they experience a resistance. And that resistance is what we think of as the heft, the mass of the particle.
Are we back to the Michelson-Morley ether in the universe, or is this something much more complex and closer to the truth?
No, you're absolutely right. It does start to sound a little bit like an ether filling space. And in rough description, it is like the ether. But also what you say is vital, because when you study the details, this notion of the Higgs field doesn't have any of the bad, unfortunate, unacceptable features of the ether. In particular, it doesn't select any perspective as being special. And that's how Higgs and others came to an idea that's consistent with all we know from relativity, that every perspective is as good as any other, and yet they were able to confer mass through this molasses through space.
Finally, Brian, does the Nobel end the debate or begin a lot of new ones here?
Well, we certainly know that the Higgs particle of a certain sort has been found by the accelerator, at CERN, but it could be that there are many Higgs particles, or maybe they're small deviations from the original idea. So there's a lot of work still to be done. So it's the opening of a door to a new era in particle physics.
The Nobel Prize in Physics honors the discovery and prediction of the Higgs boson. Brian Green, Professor of Physics and Mathematics at Columbia University, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
So from the elusive truths of physics and superstring theory to the murky hyperbole and dystopian rhetoric of the government shutdown and the debt limit deadline now looming before Congress.
The president hasn't been willing to negotiate. We want to.
House Republicans repeatedly have been compromising.
Compromise.
Compromise after compromise.
Negotiation.
In this town, you have to negotiate.
Negotiate.
We wait for the Senate to come to the negotiating table.
We should be sitting down talking.
Compromise.
In a moment, we will once again examine the extreme rhetoric associated with the Affordable Care Act and try to see if there is rationality behind the Republican initiative to bring down the government and threaten a debt default to force Democrats to eliminate what the Tea Party calls a greater evil, Obamacare. But first, to Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So we're T-minus what to the end of life as we know it here on Earth?
So hard to say. October 17th, if you listen to Jack Lew, the Treasury Secretary, guidance from Wall Street, it goes a bit longer than that because of the way Treasury pays its bills. But I don't know if I want to wade into the interim there.
As we get into this, it seems like the pressure and the leverage and the intensity is getting less rather than more. I don't understand the dynamics. Do you see behind the curtain here a little bit?
Some. John, the Republican imperatives here on the shutdown and the debt limit have shifted, and that's part of the problem. John Boehner never intended, really, to have this fight over Obamacare. He said so on the Sunday talk shows this weekend. It was supposed to be about spending and entitlements, that old fight, debt and deficit, which the public responds well to. Then the effort over August from Senator Ted Cruz and others really brought Obamacare to the fore, and you saw the speaker join in and push the issue on the shutdown on Obamacare. But John, since then, here's why it's gotten difficult. Yes, Republicans still want to shut down Obamacare. They want to capitalize on the frustration that's out there right now over the website, over the exchanges, the glitches, the problems. Republicans see political opportunity there, and they're probably right. So a lot of them want to push this fight now. But, John, it's shifted. I talked to one ringleader, Mark Meadows of North Carolina, ringleader of the shutdown Obamacare ring in the House Republican Conference the other day. He said this isn't about Obamacare anymore. This is now about veterans. This is about reservists. This is about seniors. This is about the NIH, and that it wasn't really about Obamacare. And so the arguments have shifted, and that's made it complicated.
All right. Well, we will see how much this is about Obamacare. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You bet.
And to try and peer beyond the rhetoric at the center of all this calls for a repeal or delay of Obamacare. Joining us now to explain and explore the truth behind all of this is Angie Drobnik-Holin, editor of PolitiFact. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I need a decoder here a little bit. I'm very perplexed, even as a cynical journalist, by the level of intensity in the critique and the apocalyptic characterizations of the Affordable Care Act. Do you think there's a way in which we can take some of the rhetoric and identify at least what it is the critics are talking about when they say it's going to bring on a recession or end life as we know it on the planet or profoundly unfair? I'm sure you've heard the rhetoric.
You know, we've been fact-checking exactly those kinds of claims for several years now. The healthcare law legislation started back in 2009, so we've been taking apart these claims for some time and trying to apply logic and evidence and what's actually in the law and what does it do. And often we find that the reality doesn't match up with the rhetoric.
Well, the rhetoric is about branding. The reality is about what people can actually expect in the law. Let's begin with the idea of fairness for the American people. John Boehner says, all we want is fairness for the American people. Let's reopen the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare. What is he talking about there?
You know, I'm not very clear about this fairness argument. This one seems somewhat recent. I think it helps to think about what the law says And basically, the law leaves in place the current healthcare system that we have. People who get insurance through work will still get it through work. People on Medicare will still get Medicare. So this idea that the health law overturns the entire system doesn't match up with the facts. This law leaves in place the current system and adds more regulations.
All right. And, you know, Republicans hate regulations, and that's a piece of their ideological approach to smaller government. And we can argue that yes or no. But in terms of the Affordable Care Act, the claim has been made that 75% of small businesses now say they're going to be forced to fire workers or cut their hours, either because of the costs of the ACA or the regulatory burdens of the ACA. Is there any truth to that?
You know, we looked at that claim and we rated it pants on fire. That one, there's just not much to it at all. It's a misreading of a poll. Because of the law's requirements, they want to see everyone get insured, but the law exempts most small businesses, what most people think of as a small business. Now, having said that, there are some cases of employers, and usually it's employers who have between 50 and 100 employees. Some of them do not offer health insurance, and they will either offer insurance or be forced to pay fines. But this 75% of small businesses say they're firing workers or cutting hours. It's not that many. The study that we looked at actually found less than 10% of small businesses said they would do that.
All right. Obamacare is the largest tax increase in the history of the world, according to Rush Limbaugh.
That's also pants on fire. There are some new taxes in the healthcare law. Nothing is free. They do represent the first significant federal tax increases since 1993. But we've been living in a time where taxes haven't been raised that much in recent years. But they're just not the largest in history. And we measure these increases as a percentage of the entire economy, just so people know how we measure it.
Finally, Nancy Pelosi says everybody will get more and pay less under the new health care law. And the president says the impact of the ACA is that insurance will be stronger, better, and more secure than it was before. People will not have to worry from this point on. Are those overblown endorsements of the ACA?
They're a little bit overblown. Certainly everybody is not going to be better off. Some people are going to see plans that they liked go away, particularly these kind of catastrophic plans that only kick in when you really need a large amount of care. Those plans are being phased out. We're still going to have private insurance. Employers can still change their plans when they want to. You might change insurance plans when you change jobs. It's not such a dramatic change to the system that the headaches that we have now are going to go away entirely. We're still going to have some of those headaches.
Angie Drobnik-Holin is the editor of PolitiFact. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation. You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
In American law, one thing is settled. Corporations are people.
Corporations are people, my friend. Of course they are.
That's right, my friend. Corporations have rights. A question that has been settled since the early 1800s. Another question is almost settled. Does money equal speech? When money talks in politics, is that speech protected by the First Amendment? That's the issue in a major case before the Supreme Court today. While the 2010 Citizens United case struck down campaign spending limits for corporations, labor unions, and other associations, today's case takes up the same question for individuals. Are limits on contributions for individuals basically a form of government censorship? Well, I may be oversimplifying here, which is why joining us now is Michael Kang, professor at Emory University Law School. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Is that a remotely accurate frame there of the importance of this case, a collision between money equals speech and corporations are people?
Well, it's certainly a different case than Citizens United, which dealt with a kind of campaign finance activity that we call independent expenditures, basically direct speech, and also by corporations. This case is a little bit different. It deals with individuals, as you said, and it deals with contributions, but a particular type of contribution limit. So normally when we think of contribution limits, we think of a maximum permissible amount that you're allowed to donate as an individual to a particular candidate or party or PAC. Here, what we're dealing with is a challenge to aggregate contribution limits. So that is, given a certain election cycle, you add up all the contributions that you've made. It can't exceed this aggregate limit. And it's this aggregate limit that's challenged in this case, McCutcheon.
Is the aggregate limit something that applies to most Americans, depending upon how they contribute? And, of course, evidence will be presented to the court today indicating who this applies to. Or is it just billionaires who are going to be affected by this and who would be, in a sense, liberated by this?
Yeah, the aggregate limit really applies to just a small number of people. It looks like probably under 1,000, 1,000 to 2,000 at the most. Estimates vary a little bit, but a pretty small handful of people that the aggregate limit actually affects and cuts off their ability to spend more. But that small group actually spends quite a bit on politics. And when you're talking about very, very wealthy people who are very motivated to spend on politics, they can pour a lot of money into politics. And without the aggregate limit, at least in one of the amicus briefs before the court, they estimate that one individual could give as much as $3.6 million by himself or herself to one party and the party's candidates across the 50 states.
All right. I'm an undergraduate raising my hand in one of your law school classes, and I say, what do the framers have to say on the subject of protecting the freedoms of well-motivated, very rich people to support candidates and to get involved in politics using their wallets?
Right. Campaign finance law from the very beginning and Buckley versus Valeo is really this kind of classic trade-off between the kind of First Amendment freedom to spend money on politics and express yourself politically versus what we often think of kind of equal citizenship and the ability of every citizen under a kind of theory of one person, one vote to affect the system equally in a democracy. And that's basically the tension that's run throughout campaign finance law. Certainly matters here as well. Generally speaking, the courts think of campaign finance activity as First Amendment activity that's protected by the First Amendment, and that's why we have this type of challenge. But what we're seeing is a real shift from the Rehnquist court to the current Roberts court, where the court's really much more skeptical about the government's capacity to regulate individual campaign finance activity and really much more protective of campaign finance activity as free speech that the government shouldn't be able to regulate. And Citizens United was one obvious, famous case where the court struck down longstanding federal regulations of campaign finance activity. And McCutcheon is a chance for the court, again, to strike down contribution limits, which generally courts and certainly the Supreme Court have been very deferential to the government's ability to regulate. So we might see here striking down of contribution limits, which is new. The court generally doesn't do that up until now. And really, in this case, the question is how broad the ruling is going to be, how kind of broadly.
Let me ask you on that. It seems to me the momentum from Citizens United makes almost no middle ground here, that they basically have to get rid of the limits. I don't see the logic for anything else. And is somebody going to get shouted down in the court today if they bring up the question of income disparities in the United States being at historic highs for the small number of people who have an enormous amount of wealth?
You're certainly right that I think Citizens United casts a shadow over this case because the court's taken a lot of criticism for that. And I don't think it's crazy to think that the justices are affected by a lot of that public outcry against Citizens United. I think in this case, actually, the contribution limits, I'd expect law professors aren't very good at predicting what the court will do. But I fully expect the aggregate contribution limit to get struck down. The question is how broadly the ruling is going to be and kind of what the sweep of it's going to be for future cases. And here I think arguments in the briefing actually might matter quite a bit. The justices are really going to think about how broad the ruling ought to be. So I think you're going to see a continuation of Citizens United in the sense that regulation probably is going to get struck down. But it's not obvious quite how broad that ruling is going to be and how far they're going to go.
Michael Kang is a professor at Emory University Law School. Thanks so much, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
So that's the Supreme Court. And it's a very, very important case. We'd love to know what you think about it. Should Citizens United be extended, if that is in fact what happens here, or limited in some way? And if the Congress won't end the shutdown, the government shutdown, the limits on the debt, we're asking you to give us your best last lines of a theatrical government shutdown movie.
And so, consumed by self-serving emotions, avarice and greed, they that were once giants among the righteous and good perished in poverty and degradation.
Ah, they all die in the end ending. Yes, that's a great finale from Randy, who called us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Peter wrote us on Facebook, on that cold November day, Falstaff did finally pass away from his goiter left untreated with ACA triumphantly defeated. A little Shakespeare twist there. Tell us your shutdown ending by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/TheTakeaway. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and it's day 8 of the government shutdown. And one thing is certain, we're not going to get some wise frivolity on the way out of this movie.
I guess that's pretty much now how I feel about relationships. You know, they're totally irrational and crazy and absurd. But I guess we keep going through it because most of us need the eggs.
The winsome end of Woody Allen's Annie Hall. And certainly the likes of Boehner, Pelosi, Cantor, and Obama aren't capable of an ending like this.
Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Ah, the fabulous all-time great ending from the movie Casablanca. Danny Rubin, legendary screenwriter of the movie Groundhog Day, we need an ending here, bud. Can you script doctor us out of this mess in Washington?
Well, personally, I keep hoping to just sort of wake up and it was all a dream. That's not a great ending, but
nice.
It wouldn't be a bad one.
Nice. That works perfectly. They did that in Dallas, right? a bunch of places. Not so much in the movies. What's the predicament here? And as a screenwriter, how do you think about the way this is going to end here?
Oh, well, poorly. It seems like one of those battles where everybody winds up bloodied and not much better off, no matter what the ending is. So maybe somebody learns their lesson in the end.
Ah, okay. Who would that be? So Ted Cruz has like an epiphany or something? Or
no, Ted Cruz should have a mild fishing accident. I think that might change the dynamic somewhat.
And Obama, maybe, you know, what happens to him? He goes into the Tom Clancy room there at the CIA and comes up with some sort of high-tech solution to all this?
I guess it kind of depends on whether you see him as the hero or not, because that would change the way you want the outcome, what would be satisfying to you.
Ah, so that would argue for a King Lear ending for Obama, right?
All kinds of internecine things happening up in the Capitol right now, it seems.
Now, Danny Rubin, of course, as the screenwriter for Groundhog, you really are an innovator in the time-shifting, time-travel kind of modality for getting out of really severe problems. Any sort of time-traveler, time-shifting option here?
Well, always. That's always possible. It looks like one party has gone back in time.
You're too good. You're just too good. I can't stump you. But what about if they went to, like, Justice Scalia at the Supreme Court, who actually has the power, we learn, to turn back the clock to before the government shut down, and then they do something and, you know, everyone lives happily. I'm getting bored even talking about this. It doesn't work.
I don't know if the Supreme Court solution is always satisfying to people. So, you got to be careful to please your audience, I think. And I'm not sure that would do it. I'm not quite sure what would do it.
Well, you know, a lot of movies set in Washington are about, like, blowing up the White House or taking the president hostage. Does that say anything about what the audience wants regarding Washington,
D.C.? Well, that'll keep us watching. That'll keep us watching for longer. That would make the crisis a little bit, you know, this time it's personal. Someone right. we know is being held hostage. It's tough when the entire government is held hostage.
I mean, when the North Koreans shut down the government, as in a movie last summer, people pay like 10, 11 bucks to watch it. When the Congress shuts down the government, nobody watches at all. Danny Rubin? A lot of wisdom there. Well, keep working on this problem for us.
I didn't know this was my job, but I'm on it.
Hey, freelance gig. You know, Danny Rubin, screenwriter of Groundhog Day. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
And to send your preferred ending to the fiasco in Washington, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Shakespearean style endings, welcome.
And in the end,
speaking of endings, the Higgs boson giveth mass, the black hole taketh away the universe as we know it. Even my elementary school kids know that the sun is going to run out of fuel in a few billion years and be incapable, among other things, of deepening John Boehner's tan. Hollywood has endings. The universe has endings. This line, I can't wait to say. Endings are the genesis of the latest live and broadcast project of Jad Abumrad and Robert Krolwich, our friends at Radiolab. Welcome, Robert and Jad.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
So you guys
How about
are...
How about this? Her auburn hair glistened in the late, late twilight. Her lips were rosy. But because she worked at the Agricultural Pesticide Registration Bureau, I never saw her again.
Like that.
Is that an ending to the
No,
to
that's
the thing?
That's the thing. That's his challenge that he was just doing.
Oh, I see.
The backstory to the government shutdown. Well,
yes.
You guys are actually on a live tour, and your show is really embracing this whole issue of endings writ large, way beyond Washington. The tour is called Apocalyptical. Tell me about it a little bit.
It's very of the moment.
Unintentionally. We're so rarely of the moment, but here we are.
Yeah.
Oh, you always say that, Jad. It's unintentional, but I know you've got some secret sort of control panel in your office that knows the zeitgeist.
You know, we had insider information on the calamity that's upon us, and I don't know how we got on endings, really. I think we were reading about...
You have breakfast with God every alternate Tuesday, and he tells you stuff.
he's like, you know, November. Watch out for November. You know, we were reading about this... Robert was reading a book about the end of the giant reptiles, and it's a story we all think we know, and suddenly he happened upon a phrase which he relayed to me that completely upended everything we thought we knew. And I don't know, somehow that was the moment and tumbled out of it. And here we are standing on a stage with enormous dinosaur puppets and the most amazing musicians I've ever stood next to. And it seems to all go back to that moment. I don't know.
It's really a lot of fun. I don't know. Sometimes it's sort of, yes, the subject is a little daunting, but the playfulness and the adventure of it on a stage is really, it's a very cool thing to see. And we're going to be doing it like in many places,
and
all the way out to the Bay Area and California, everywhere.
Just as the news guy here, so it wasn't the asteroid regarding the dinosaurs and the dinosaur puppets?
It was the asteroid, but in a way that is there's a new theory about that asteroid, which is it seems so preposterous when I read about it. And then when we began looking at the details, the preposterosity of it became slightly more plausible, to the point where it just seemed worth actually telling people about. It's a very radical theory to describe the end of the dinosaurs, and it's you have to come. That's all.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we'll get to hear this, right, on stage?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. These are two of the dudes that we're going to be playing with. This is Glenn Cochi and Darren Gray. They make the band On Fillmore. So these guys, you can't quite hear it in this excerpt, but like Glenn plays percussion, Darren plays the bass, and they do it in a way that is just unorthodox. What's seven levels beyond unorthodox?
Seven levels would be, say to them, what is the sound of a pane glass window shattering on top of a little bird in a puddle?
And they
make instruments in front of you to actually to create the sound.
They use gardening implements on their drums.
Things in their mouths and weird.
Darren plays his bass guitar like a tuba.
Yeah.
Which doesn't seem possible, but yet he does it.
Sign me up, guys.
Before
we go, what is the, for lack of a better word, takeaway for your audience? What do you want them to get out of this notion of endings when they leave your fabulous performances?
I think it just, as usual, a sense of beauty and wonder at the end of the day.
Yeah, that even at the end, there's an awe and a wonder to simply being alive.
Yeah.
And that's all the time we have. Robert Krowich, co-host of our good friends Radiolab, their apocalyptical tour all over the United States. Check your local public radio listings. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Take you now into a world where warm and cold interact, light and darkness coexist, and the Earth's watery domain embraces the most solid of land. I'm not talking about a sunset at the beach. Instead, an anomaly of ice and rock, mountain and river that exists almost no place on Earth. Caves carved by the motions of ice against plates of rock that create worlds unto themselves below ground. Perhaps the longest on Earth of these glacial caves outside of Alaska has recently been discovered under Mount Hood in the state of Oregon. Amelia Templeton is a reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting's EarthFix project, and she helped co-produce OPB's remarkable multimedia exploration of these caves called Thin Ice, Exploring Mount Hood's Glacier Caves. You can see it all at opb.org/glaciercaves, and while you will be amazed by what you see, you'll end up being a little envious of what Amelia Templeton was able to experience firsthand.
What we were exploring were glacier caves, which are kind of a specific kind of ice cave. They're these amazing passageways that can form underneath a glacier where the ice contacts bedrock and also entirely within the ice of a glacier. And there's really only a handful of people worldwide, I would say, who are trying to explore these places. You need to have a very specific skill set, and you also need to be, I think, just a little bit crazy to want to climb underneath a glacier and basically through what constitutes a glacier's plumbing system.
And I say this out of respect, Amelia, but apparently on all counts, you qualify there.
Well, sort of. I would have been unable to access these places if it had not been for the help of Brent McGregor and Eddie Cartaya, the two cavers that we were following. And really, what it takes to find a place and explore a place like this is different than what it takes to lead somebody like me up there. And the two of them have spent a year, not just in this first cave, but they've discovered two more caves and have mapped more than a mile of passages in this glacier.
And let's give you a sense of the intensity of these characters, Brent McGregor and Eddie Cartaya. Listen.
I'm belaying my partner, and his life could depend on what I do. All I can do at that point is give him my 100% attention.
Huge fracture. Big fracture when I did that.
Brent McGregor and Eddie Cartaya in the Snow Dragon Cave, and here's Eddie on his own.
The underlying force of caving is discovery. So cavers, they're obsessive. But if there's a possibility of getting into a new passage or finding a new cave or surveying a new cave, that'll suck a caver in. They'll quit work.
That will suck a caver in. Did you get sucked into these caves as you were exploring them? Obviously not in the same way as these two, but still, is there an allure?
Oh, absolutely. There's actually a word that the caving community uses for it. They call it cave fever. And that's when a caver hears about a new cave that nobody's explored and mapped yet. And they'll literally call in sick, you know, just take off and go spend a week exploring this new place. So I definitely got a little bit of cave fever myself. And to me, how that really manifested itself, I think, the first time I stepped foot in Snowdragon, which is the easiest of the caves to get to and explore, I really felt pretty uncomfortable and pretty nervous. And for good reason, because you are in this huge ballroom of ice and there are flakes of ice that are starting to pull away from the ceiling, and those can fall and hurt you or kill you pretty easily. And I sort of felt this anxiety and a little bit of claustrophobia. And by the end of my 5 days up on the mountain, that nervousness had been replaced just by real joy and curiosity and a love of these places.
How alien of an environment is it, or magical of an environment? Tell me about the light, how the ice interacts with the actual rock of the earth in the mountain.
It's definitely magical. The ice is multifaceted. It's first of all layered, kind of like a layer cake. It forms as each annual snowfall compresses and becomes ice over time. So you can sort of look back and read some of the glacier's history. There are in places these beautiful, clear layers of ice along with this sort of cloudy, milky ice. And those, we were told, are when rain fell on the glacier and then froze very quickly and formed these perfect clear layers. And then because these caves are melting out, both through water flowing through them and from warm air, it kind of looks like somebody has been carving at the ice with an enormous ice cream scoop. So there's this kind of scalloped ceiling, and there are waterfalls in places. I mean, there's water flowing through all of these caves. So there's these sort of whitewater rivers in the middle, and then periodically water is kind of carving its way down through the glacier, and so there'll just be these little spouts of water that will come out of the walls. It's very dramatic and very beautiful.
And I can hear this just sense of just loving reverence in your voice. Is it the case that you may be among the last generation to ever see these glacier caves because of climate change?
Well, you know, these are caves that are discovered very recently and that likely won't last for very long. It's hard to say exactly, but we spent some time with a glaciologist up on the glacier, and his prediction was that before too long, the caves may essentially open up a giant trench that cuts the glacier in half. If you look at the history of this glacier, the Sandy Glacier, it's lost more than half of its ice in the last 100 years. And even the fact that these caves have formed is actually a sign that the glacier is very thin, much, much thinner than it used to be. Under thick ice, you would never get caves like this. The ice kind of flows like silly putty and squeezes shut these kinds of openings. So the caves themselves are definitely a sign that the glacier is thinning and retreating pretty dramatically. They're also accelerating that process because they let all this warm air up in underneath the glacier. And I would doubt that my children will see these places.
Amelia Templeton, great work. You can see it at the opb.org/glacier caves site where the exploration of these new caves underneath Mount Hood, new in terms of human contact, but certainly not new. Amelia Templeton, congratulations and thanks so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
Amelia Templeton is a reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting's Earth Fix project and co-produced OPB's multimedia project, Thin Ice, Exploring Mount Hood's Glacier Caves. Be a part of the conversation. We'd love to know your preferred ending for the fiasco in Washington. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Finally, this hour, there were two things that annoyed or exasperated legendary journalist and longtime London Sunday Times war correspondent Marie Colvin. First, that in a war zone, you could get injured and cut off and sometimes be unable to file your stories back to London or New York. She hated that. And second, that her reputation for courage and daring made her the focus of stories, distracting from the people, the innocent civilians who she sought to protect everywhere she went, from East Timor to Lebanon to Libya and finally Syria, where she died in a rocket attack in February of 2012 in the besieged Syrian city of Homs. Marie Colvin would be outraged if this segment did not begin by reminding everyone of the more than 100,000 civilians who have died in that civil war and by noting that under United Nations supervision, Syria's chemical weapons arsenal is being dismantled, a very preliminary but hopeful sign. With that out of the way, I can say how much I miss my friend Marie Colvin, knowing that she will not be too annoyed with me for excessive sentimentality. A keen talent for avoiding sentimentality of any kind is certainly one of the talents that made my next guest an ideal collaborator with Marie Colvin in her war assignments. Collaborator with Marie Colvin, that is a very rare club in this profession of journalism. Paul Conroy is a journalist and photographer and author of the new book, Under the Wire, Marie Colvin's Final Assignment. Welcome, Paul, to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having us on, John.
Paul, how hard of a story was this for you to tell, given all of the recovery that you've had to come through, given that you were in the same attack that Marie Colvin was in, the one that killed her?
I think writing the book was part of the recovery, to be honest. What happened in Homs when the rocket attack happened and Marie was killed, it was very sudden, it was out of the blue, and I never got a chance to say goodbye, essentially. So when I was brought out of Syria and I had the bad injuries, I couldn't walk, I was in a hospital bed. In essence, I brought Marie back to life, writing a book, you know, hopefully to show the world, you know, exactly what a character she was, what we'd lost. But I remember sitting writing and just going through virtually every conversation we had on that final assignment. So it was a great process, you know, for 6 months maybe while I was writing. I almost felt like I had Marie back.
At the moment that you understood that she was dead, you also understood that you possibly had a mortal injury. Just describe some of those details, and then we'll move on to some of the bigger issues of why Marie Colvin is such an important character.
We were in the building that morning. We'd done a lot of interviews the night before, CNN, BBC, Channel 4. Really, as soon as we woke the next day, the attack started. They closed in with rockets and eventually found a target, and the bombardment of the house happened. Three rockets hit and we survived. And as the fourth rocket hit, I got my camera out thinking, I'll get a shot of this. This is the true horror of what these people are going through, the civilians, the women and children. As I picked the camera up, there was just an almighty bang. I stayed conscious, but I don't know how. And I just felt like a piece of stone, a rock had hit me like I'd been hit by a bit of masonry. But when I put my hand down to feel the wound, my hand just slipped through my leg. It went in one side and out the other side. And for the first 10 seconds, I actually did think, oh no, hospital food, this is going to be awful. You know, cold potatoes, lumpy gravy. And it was the most bizarre set of thoughts. And then I felt for the artery, checked that was okay, because I knew, because it was a thigh wound, that I was in grave danger from that artery was cut. I was over. So I immediately put on a kefir, the Arab scarf that I was wearing around my leg, tried to put a tourniquet on. I was still losing blood, so I went to look for Marie. That was my immediate thought. Where's Marie now? I think I've saved my leg. And I fell, took two steps, maybe fell into the rubble, where sadly I fell next to Marie and Remy Oschlick, the French photographer, and they were both dead. But I further bleeding was happening from my leg, so I grabbed an Ethernet cable from in the rubble and put a second tourniquet on just to try and stem that flow of blood. I knew if I kept bleeding, I had minutes to live. So it was a very hectic few moments. I can feel it now as I talk about it.
Well, the remarkable story of how you got out, given those wounds, is told in this book, Under the Wire, Marie Colvin's Final Assignment. But at that moment that you knew she was dead, an era ended for world journalism, in a sense. Marie Colvin had no respect for the rules, the paperwork that was required to get past checkpoints, to get in and out. You were smuggled into Syria. Describe Marie's contempt for the rules of journalism.
Well, yeah, many of the rules say that we should never have been in that place in the first place. You know, I think any kind of piece of paper with health and safety written on it, you know, we were both kind of snigger at and make a joke of it. You know, we had no visas, but we knew that what was happening in Homs was a humanitarian crisis of the utmost degree. And there was nothing that would stop Marie. and I was of the same mind. So, you know, we went across with arms smugglers across the mountains illegally into Syria, in the full knowledge that we'd been told by Lebanese Italian intelligence that if anybody was found, Western journalists in that area, they were to be executed and their body thrown on a battlefield. We knew all of this, and you know, pretty much everything said do not go there. But the, you know, Marie's passion and tenacity for a story was enough to override that. In this game, there are no rules when it comes to, if you want to get to the heart of that story and not see it as a geopolitical story, you know, the end results of war are the people on the ground. They are the people who suffer these results, and that is where Marie's heart was. She would break any rule to get past the bureaucracy and get to the heart of the story. She was the most tenacious person I've ever met.
How did she convey her invulnerability to the people around her, the people that she ordered around, and also her humor, the people who she made laugh hysterically in the midst of horror?
We were awful together for laughing, you know, but that's the way we kept each other going. But she would do it to other people. I remember in Libya, we tracked down the guy who found Gaddafi, the young lad who spotted them in the alcove, and he didn't want to talk. So Marie begins like, okay, she takes off her leather jacket and starts saying, here's a gift for you. And the guy's laughing and Marie's laughing and everyone ran. She just broke the ice by taking off her jacket, saying, come on, take me jacket. And that way people got laughing. She was going, no, I'm serious, take it. And within 10 minutes, this young lad was sitting there telling the blow-by-blow account of just how he found Gaddafi. And I think anyone else could have approached that guy and tried every angle, but Marie spotted a way to do it, and that was a gift that she had. She saw that it was going to be a tricky one, and she spotted that nook and went for it.
Marie laughed in a bittersweet way about some of the deficiencies in her personal life and how much of a loner she ended up being. And you make a few comments about the perils of your own personal life. Was she lonely at the end? And is there any chance that your personal life is going to improve over the next couple of years?
I think that's one of the last lines in the book. My personal life remains one of the most dangerous places for a journalist to operate. I think there's something about the job we do and the type of personalities that do this job. I mean, Marie had a wonderful circle of friends in the States and in England. But, you know, she was driven to do this job. And, you know, it was a lonely job. You know, if you don't have the ability to take a step back from home and friends and all the comforts and want to go out there knowing that it's going to be a lonely period, then I don't think you can do the job as Marie did it. I think that was one of the connections that really made us a good team, was we both had the ability to do that. And I think, yes, yeah, sometimes your personal life does suffer as a consequence of that.
Paul Conroy is the author of Under the Wire, Marie Colvin's Final Assignment. Paul, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, John.
We'll end this hour with a thought of the people of Syria, trapped in a war that continues, vulnerable even now. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.